We'll call the House Committee on Health Care to order and see if I can give you a little insight into the direction we're going, which I haven't figured out myself yet because I've got members coming and going, at least for the next half hour. First of all, 2967 will not be heard today. If anybody is here involved in that. And I think, I'm not sure, but I think we will probably start House Bill 3000, I'm sorry, between 3 and 315. Would you let Representative Buckley and Chris Edwards know that? I'm thinking about 3 or 315. Even if we're not there, we'll stop, and if they're here at that time, we'll have them testify on that bill. We've got some at about 3:30. Whenever I get a whole committee, we'll take up the amendments to House Bill 2009. And our intention in that case is we may ask a couple of people to talk to us, but basically what we're going to do is to adopt the Dash 10 amendments into House Bill 2009, which is a complete gut and stuff, superseding both the bill itself and the 09s, as some of you have seen, cleans up a few of the problems in the 09. We're going to refer it to the House floor with no recommendation, with a subsequent referral back to us. It's a little wacky political maneuver, but what it, I mean, not political maneuver, it has nothing political, procedural maneuver. procedural maneuver to allow the bill to be printed in what looks like a final form. And we can't get the so-called A engrossed form unless we send it out and then back to us. That will allow us to make the final amendments. We'll begin talking about a set of other amendments on Monday, Tuesday night probably, and Wednesday with the still target of adopting those amendments into the bill and moving the bill to the Revenue Committee Wednesday, or failing that, Friday. But that's the current plan. And part of that decision is whether the tax... the provider tax component will be in 2009 or 2116, I think. Is that right? It will be in either separated or a part of 2009. And as I've said before, that's a decision being made above my pay grade. We've got a couple of bills. Representative Maurer, you have something to talk to us about, and apparently the OMA does as well, on 2435. And Representative Harker, did I say that wrong?
E-2345?
2345. Representative Harker has some things to talk to us about on 2435, and there are both, Representative Harker will be here in a half an hour, and I understand the Oregon Medical Association has offered some conceptual amendments on both of them. I mean, some amendments that will turn into real amendments if we give any indication we're willing to move them. So why don't I open up a work session on House Bill 2345 and let Representative Maurer talk to us about where we think we are, and then we'll... You have some amendments, too, is that right?
Yes.
In and front we of might move those amendments in, huh?
Correct. In front of you, you have a Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2345 and also a hand engrossed version of House Bill 2345, and we will pass out the conceptual amendments from the Oregon Medical Association, and I will, Courtney, if you could come forward, I'd appreciate it.
I don't have the hand engrossed.
Here, you can look at mine.
Well, let's put this between us. Oh, here's another whole pack of things. Okay.
The goal today is to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. We don't have a fiscal, so we couldn't move it out of committee anyway. But to at least address the concerns of the Oregon Medical Association, which we got this afternoon and have not been, they were attempting to distribute it to all the stakeholders in the work group. And I think some of their concerns are very legitimate. And I'll let Stresser speak to the general concern about the bill overall, if she wants to speak to the amendments.
And the dash two amendments are the ones that you proposed after working with the
Correct.
Before and we had this input from OMA.
Correct. And you know, not to say that there's consensus amongst the work groups. We'll make that very clear.
Would you take a moment and walk us through the
Mr.
The
Chair, I will attempt to.
Somebody else help you on this one?
Is there a representative?
Okay. Hold on then.
Should we send Representative Buckley?
Why don't we close the... Would you guys like to testify now?
That's fantastic.
Okay. Let's close the work session on 2, 3, 4, 5, and open a work session on House... Oh, it's a public hearing.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Open a public hearing on 3000. We'll take testimony from these two fine gentlemen, and we'll then close the public hearing, the public hearing for a while, and get back to it a bit later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley from South Jackson County, and Mr. Chair, I think you gave our staff a great adrenaline rush. I think you made a comment about the bill being open, or hearing the bill at 3:15 or something like that, so our staff's been running, chasing us down and dragging us here.
I meant 4:15. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry.
It's good for all of us to go exercise in the
here we are, just as I said, hearing it at 3:15.
Just as you said, it happened, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Very briefly, I just want to thank you for your time and your consideration of this issue. As I think most of you know, Representative Edwards, myself, there a number of legislators have been focusing on the issue of children with autism and children with developmental disabilities in our state, the impact that's having on families, on communities, in our schools. We are trying to take as comprehensive a look as possible on what the impact is for our kids, number one, and for our families. We are doing everything we possibly can in terms of addressing the lifespan of an Oregonian with autism or developmental disabilities. What exists for a child from age 0 to 5? What exists after a child enters the school system? What exists both educationally and in terms of our healthcare system? The bill we're bringing forward to you today is a bill that's very similar to legislation that's been passed in a number of states around the country, which tries to address the issue of treatment for children with autism through their insurance plans and what coverage should be provided to give a child the best chance possible to receive treatment that will have an impact on that child and give that child the best chance possible to live the most independent life as they possibly can. So my job here today, Mr. Chair and members, is simply to again thank you for taking this issue up. Thank you for your attention for it, and Chair Greenlick, thank you for the extended time you've given to this issue in the discussions we had both last session and in the interim. We're wrestling with this, and the state needs to wrestle with it, not only for our families, our communities, and our schools, but for the state as well, for the investments that we need to make in order to deal with this in an intelligent and humane way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Edwards, State Representative, House District 14 in West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. During the interim, at the direction and appointment of Chair Greenlick and now Co-Chair Buckley, but then Chair Buckley, who was Chair of the House Education Committee, I was, at their direction, appointed Chair of a legislative work group to take up the issue of autism and look at how we might improve the state's response to the burgeoning numbers here in Oregon. And, of course, here in Oregon, our numbers are higher than the national average at 1 in 89 kids in our school system being on the autism spectrum. My son, Simon, is one of those kids. He's in the first grade. He's doing quite well, but certainly it is autism, and it presents its own challenges. So I bring to this issue not necessarily an expert's perspective from a healthcare standpoint or an expert education perspective, but really an expert parenting perspective. And as we did our report and we took our report on the road around Oregon, from Bend to Northeast Portland to Eugene to Southwest Portland to Coos Bay and Medford and Salem, Corvallis, Astoria, Ontario, and did I miss one? I think I might have missed one. Klamath Falls. They were
not many.
Wow. I mean, we hit the entire state.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we heard at nearly every single stop were cries from parents who were financially strapped, or not even financially strapped, but simply looking for a finance mechanism to pay for treatment for their kids. One can only imagine if you're a parent yourself, what it's like to receive that diagnosis and then be subject to essentially waiting in line in what is, let's be honest, a somewhat bureaucratic system for delivering services to kids. And the services, I would argue, that are essential, I would argue, are underfunded. And while many of them are quite effective, you're always looking for what else could you do as a parent. And so it's only natural that because autism as a neurological condition lies at the intersection between education and healthcare and total wellness, it just makes sense that there would be an education response and that there would be a healthcare response as well. So I thank Representative Buckley for his work on this issue. I thank the chair of the committee and the members of the committee for taking the issue up. And I will leave it at that, lest I cut into too much into other folks' time who probably have more substance to lend to the issue than I. Thank you.
Before I ask for questions, I do want to comment on the extraordinary job both of you have done. I joined at least in one of Representative Edwards' meetings around the state. I too have a grandchild with Asperger's, and I've watched the effect on the family of this disease. And the one thing, whether this is the right answer or not at this time, the one thing that's absolutely clear is this is an extraordinary problem. It has extraordinary effect on kids and their families. It has extraordinary effect on the classrooms, and it has extraordinary effect as we move forward into the lifespan, as I think Representative Buckley said, as these kids go off to college, go off to find jobs, go off into find living. And the human cost that is related to this disease is really quite amazing. And we heard case after case after case. I don't know how you managed to do. How many did you do? Six?
There's a bunch.
I don't know how you managed to survive listening to these stories, which you live every day yourself. You folks are quite amazing on this one. Yes, Representative Bruin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for doing this. My question is, question comment. Was it a known or an unknown when we passed mental health parity 4 years ago that this was in effect going to fall through the cracks? I mean, my guess was it was an unknown, and it's disconcerting to me. But I mean, I don't remember conversations around this 4 years ago. Do either of you?
And
why has it fallen through the cracks with what I thought was a very proud achievement, mental health parity?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin. I'm with you on that. I do not remember those discussions around mental health parity, and this does, as you say, fall through the crack. It is, as Representative Edwards says, there's the education component part of it, and there's the healthcare part of the component. There's physical health. There's mental health. It's entwined in a way unlike most anything else you can think of doing. And again, to emphasize, we are on the education front. We're working with early childhood groups and early intervention groups to figure out how can the state best use our resources in the early childhood years to tackle the education front in a more aggressive way. And what we're asking for this bill is for all of us involved, including insurance companies, to join in this effort to make sure that if the state can push forward, can we push forward on the front for healthcare coverage as well?
Thank you, Kenneman.
Thank you. Appreciate you bringing this bill forward. As a psychologist, I know a little bit of this challenge, but didn't work much with it. And I think, you know, some of the issues around diagnosis and treatment plan are highly appropriate. I guess my only question is really more a technical one. The actual bill cites the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 4th edition. That will soon be obsolete. And that's not consistent with the way we usually write standards, and I'm just wondering, we may want to look at the current edition or some other appropriate thing, because it changes every few years, and I was before they even had DSM-1 when I started my training.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, that is the diagnostics issue is being taken up as part of the commission that has just been formed by the governor's executive order. So there's going to be a whole work group that is subcommittee of that commission that's going to be working on diagnostic issues and reconciling the differences between education diagnosis, medical diagnosis, and what all that means. So it is complicated.
Yes, it is.
Representative Kotick, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, thank you, both of you. I did attend one of the meetings in my district, so there has been a lot of work. I think what I like about your bill, I'm intrigued by needing to define what an autism service provider is, and I was wondering if this is language from other states. Is this new language? Are we leading edge here because we're trying to quantify who can actually do some of this work? And I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotick, what we have before you is taken from a template that has been used in other states, and there is, of course, additional changes that hopefully would fit our state, and we can, at a different time, talk you through which came from which, but I don't have that information with me today.
I can see where that would be helpful to have that kind of element defined.
You bet.
I would assume have it nowhere else in statute at this point.
I believe so.
Thank you.
I have a broader question I really like Chris and perhaps other witnesses to talk about later. I think it's quite unusual to have a mandate that prescribes a particular treatment. And in line, on page 2 and line 41, this specifically mandates the applied behavior analysis as a treatment. How did you react to the Health Resources Commission's report on the extent to which there's medical evidence that has a broad-based... There is not medical evidence that this particular treatment across the board seems to work. And as I read the report, it works sometimes in some cases. It's not clear when, and doesn't work other times in other cases.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, I think it's a good point that you bring up, and what I have maintained a focus on is that we are getting appropriate treatments to these kids, and that those treatments aren't held to a higher standard than perhaps other treatments for other conditions. And so, I mean, there's been... I've heard so many both professionals and parents who have said, look, this really, really worked for my child. And there are some studies that are inconclusive, and And I guess I would be concerned that we would hold applied behavior analysis to a higher standard for insurance coverage than we might treatment for, you pick a condition, another condition.
But we don't, by statute, mandate the treatment, mandate a specific treatment for any other condition I can think of, I think. I may be wrong about that, but I think this is pretty unusual to not only mandate service for a disease, which we did in a bill this is modifying, but mandating that there's insurance coverage on a very specific treatment. That seems unusual.
It is perhaps unusual, and being the healthcare committee, you would have a better perspective than I would on how unusual it is. But it's certainly it's an unusual and a unique condition. And
sure,
and because of where it lies, I mean, there have been loopholes, for lack of a better word, that have really stymied efforts to get coverage. So I think, you know, the bill you see before you is a little bit more prescriptive. So,
thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
members.
For all your work and for this bill specifically, we'll be looking at it very carefully.
Thank you.
I close the public hearing on House Bill 3000 to be reopened later in the afternoon and go back to where we were, reopen a work session on House Bill 2345. If we committee after that, I will probably open 2604 after this. And take testimony from me.
Okay. Mr. Essler.
Can we get you back?
Somebody else? Yes, thank you. So, there were a series of work groups on the impaired professional program, and for most people, this is inside baseball, unless you happen to be on the board or a provider or on the unfortunate receiving end as a patient of the result of an impaired provider, which is what we are trying to ultimately prevent. Currently, the impaired provider program are embedded within four licensing boards: the Oregon Medical Board, the Nursing Board, the Pharmacy Board, and the Dental Board. And what we are attempting to do with 2345 is rip the impaired professional program out of the boards and create a new standalone within DHS as a place to house it, impaired professional program, and another separate entity within DAS, Department of Administrative Services, called a monitoring entity, and that there would be a clear and bright line between the role of the monitoring program, which may just be a single person, and the impaired professional program, however large that is, and the professional licensing boards. And the amendment, the Dash 2, attempts to articulate that in statutory language. Now, there is no guarantee that we've succeeded in that attempt. And we know that there is still some controversy among boards and different groups. So I'm going to be quiet, and I'm hoping that we can have some input from our panel on where they feel this amendment gets us and where some of the challenges are. We know that we're running up against the clock. Next Friday is April 17th, which is the last day before we run out of time. And at that point...
Actually, not quite.
Well, not quite. It's work session scheduled, which I guess we're in, but, and we can carry it forward. But at some point, the clock will run out. but we much prefer, Representative Greenlick and I much prefer to have a bill that may not have consensus, but is not being vehemently opposed by different groups. And if we have to move it out of this committee to the floor, and if there were other concerns, to deal with it on the Senate side. But hopefully we won't have to get to that point. So I'm going to open it up and allow you to comment.
Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. First, I would like to thank the Vice Chair for his work, Vice Chair Maurer, for his work on this work group, which was at times unruly, I'm sure, but we did get something out of that with the Dash 2 amendments. However, as sometimes happens when things go to LC and come back, it's not quite clear. I should just state one more time for the record that the OMA obviously has some overall objections to this legislative concept from day one. We believe that the HPP program has provided quality care, is protecting patients and protecting physicians in helping them through their addiction issues. However, we did participate in the work group. And again, we do have some concerns. You have those in front of you, and I'd be more than happy to kind of walk through those. The first concern starts on page 2 of the Dash 2 amendments, lines 7, 8, and 9. This, I think this is statement is kind of misspelled.
I think you're accurate.
Yeah, in some way. I think the word practice is supposed to be practiced. If you read it as is right now, they would be investigating a licensee's actual practice and not how they practiced. We also would like to see maybe something a little more clear and a statement such as the investigation is in the healthcare setting.
Speaking of words, what do you mean by, in your statement, that this statement is interrupted to mean?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure.
The next paragraph?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think that's supposed to be interpreted.
It is easy to get the words
wrong.
Yeah,
see? Everyone does it. Even people who read over this email. So if we could fix that, that would probably make it a bit clearer. I think we all know what the intent was. But if we could also add something about healthcare settings to make sure that the investigation is within the licensee's
Courtney,
healthcare
rather than
setting.
Go through every detail.
Yep. Nope. I'm done.
Okay.
Page 2, lines 10 and 11. If you read that as is, it basically states that the board would be able to enter in the licensee's name into a criminal database. I think they meant to query the licensee, so that's not very clear. Page 2, lines 21 and 22.
I think this would be probably appropriate to handle offline.
Okay. But obviously,
if these things are corrected, are you going to oppose it, whatever?
We'd have to go back to the group, but to our internal group. But I think we would feel a bit better if we could get some of these things a little bit clearer on
will
record.
Will your internal group tell you, let us know whether you're going to oppose it,
mm-hmm.
whatever we do?
Yep.
That would be very helpful, and I think it will help President Maurer figure out where we're going with it.
I think we've always agreed that there could be the monitoring agency part, the staff monitoring. We're totally fine with that. We still would like to see the program remain under the Oregon Medical Board.
Which program?
The actual treatment and HPP, impaired professional program. The monitoring agency.
Which is really kind of the crux of our problem is the board doing treatment.
And we felt if we had the separate monitoring agency, that would kind of conquer some of the issues.
Thank you. Mercer?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Holly Mercer. I'm the executive director of the Board of Nursing. This process has been going on for about a year, and many of us have worked many hours, and we appreciate Representative Maurer for taking on the somewhat unruly group. But We believe these Dash 2 amendments mostly get us there. We're concerned with particular language that we think that every board that wants to have an impaired professional program should have the same standards, whether you're a dentist, a doctor, a nurse, a pharmacist. And we think that this bill was a great effort to get us there. And I know that there was a lot of hard work put around the details of this bill, and I would hope that this committee focuses not just on the licensees, but on the public health of all Oregonians that deserve to know that when any health professional is in an impaired program, they have the same standards. And I think that these amendments mostly get us there, and I'd really like to see this bill go forward with some of these tweaks. As to the database that's referenced here, we found at the Board of Nursing, and if you would have asked anyone at the Board of Nursing about a year and a half ago if we had a successful nurse monitoring program, people within the board would have said, yes, we do. And it took new eyes and people opening those files and checking whether or not people were followed up on positive urinalysis, whether or not they were turning in reports, whether or not they had arrests. And we needed to do that. And I think now we have a better program, but from a public safety perspective, we feel very strongly that these professions need to be treated the same when it comes to this disease. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we are going to pass this bill in one form or another out of the committee to the floor. So the question is, what form is that? And I think you feel relatively confident you can move very quickly to that.
Very quickly. And we have gone back to all the stakeholders, asked them for input in writing, and we've gotten some. And we will move forward with another amendment. But the intent today is to pass or to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to help us in the fiscal process.
You have a motion? Work session.
We're in work session? Yeah. I will make a motion. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2345 dated April 3rd, 2009.
Representative Maurer moves that we move the amendments, the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2345. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. And we'll hear again. I suspect may have a dash threes before we're ready to move it, at which point we can get a fiscal, I think, and then we can be prepared to move it. So we close the work session on House Bill 2345. And can we stand at ease for a moment, please? order.
Flushed out.
And I would like to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2604 and hand the gavel. Let's see how Representative Parker does with the gavel.
What?
Yeah, we need to get the rookies trained, you know. And I would like to testify if I can find my bill.
Okay, Roxy's coming.
Can we gavel them
down? I can't find it. Yeah, you can. Thank you.
Gavel them down.
I'm out of here, right?
Right here.
Nothing's been moved today.
We're on 2604.
Are you ready?
Yes.
In session?
I'm ready.
I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and thank you for inviting me to testify, Mr. Chair.
You may begin.
Keep 2 minutes here.
Keep it brief.
And I'm a rookie at this.
Where's that timer?
Please be nice to me.
Beep, beep, beep.
I'm here to testify on House Bill 2604. And House Bill 2604 is a relatively simple bill. It's what I've modeled after the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that requires CEOs of corporations to sign the financial reports of the organizations to show that they've been actively involved in those decisions. We've had some catastrophic breaches of security in the healthcare field, and many of them were breaches not because there was violation of the policies on the protection of privacy in the organization, but because they were following the procedures. The most noted example is a healthcare system in Portland where a subgroup of that system had, as a matter of policy, the disaster protection plan for the data of a sub-agency in that system, that somebody would take home a computer with all the department's data on it so it would be kept in their home in case there was a fire in the agency overnight. It didn't take long for there to be a break-in into a car where that computer was housed. And 335,000 or so patient records were possibly exposed to confidential violations. Turned out the organization responded wonderfully to that. I want to make sure we're not talking about who it is. They reacted in a perfectly appropriate way with horror. And the press conference that followed, the CEO of the organization said, "We're going to find out who's at fault, and they're going to end up being held responsible for this." Well, that's what triggered me to get the bill, because it's clear who was responsible. It's the CEO of the organization. And all this bill does is basically two things. It requires CEOs of organizations that have personal data systems in their organizations to periodically certify that they have personally reviewed the confidentiality procedures, the data protection procedures of their organization, and that they have notified their own board privately, not publicly, but have notified their own board if there's been any breach in the confidentiality of their records. Basically, it does that. Will this change the world? It won't change the world, but I know the CEOs of most of the major organizations, and I know how responsible individuals they are. And I know if they're signing a paper that says they have personally reviewed these procedures, they will, in fact, have reviewed these procedures and asked the kind of questions that needs to be asked of their own organization. This is absolutely not something to put blame on people. It's not something to produce expensive new requirements on healthcare systems. It simply is a matter of making explicit who's responsible in an organization for making sure the protection of confidential records is in their hands. And basically, I think that's all this bill does. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I think somebody else has signed up to testify as well.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What is the purpose of submitting or making a filing to the Office of Health Policy and Research and not just maintaining that as part of a public disclosure within the facility or organization itself?
This is an ascertainment piece that, I mean, I forget the term. It's a filing of a certification that makes it a public record that they've done so. Would it be just as good to have the law that they certify it and keep it in their own files? I think that would be possibly another way to manage it, but this gets that certification into the public record. It's a simple form, so it shouldn't be all that complicated. And at least on the hospital side, this would be a part of their annual filing. And I think on the health insurance side, it would also be a part of their annual filing to DCBS as it now stands. It wouldn't even be a new file. It would be a new form in their filing.
Representative Thompson?
I have a question as to whether or not the CEO, in reviewing the system they have in place, would be able to pick up a problem. I mean, obviously, in the case you cited, I'm sure it wasn't in their protocol that an employee leave the computer in the backseat of a car. It must have been envisioned in their protocol that the employee would secure the computer in some fashion. You know, I can see where the problems can occur, but you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea to secure the data off-site in case of fire. And obviously something fell through the cracks. But
yeah, but not in the back of a car.
Yeah, but would a CEO be able to look at their protocol and be able to say, wow, I really like this, except if the employee leaves the computer in the back of their car, now we have a problem? I'm not sure they'd pick that up if they looked at the two-volume security policy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, you and I have both worked in large organizations.
Unfortunately, that's true.
And you and I both know that when the CEO asks for something, it tends to come in higher quality than if it was not asked for by the CEO. Yeah. It's my sense that the CEO looking through them is not going to say, ooh, what's this on page 16, line 14?
Okay.
It's going to be the folks responsible in their organization bringing them the forms and knowing their boss is going to sign and make public that they've reviewed them, that those procedures will be good. And I think that's the mechanism that this works.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Does this give the individual, in your case, where the 350,000 individuals had the information stolen out of the back of the car, remember that case all too well, and you mentioned this was modeled after Sarbanes-Oxley, and so I guess I'm going to express a little bit of my ignorance over the cure mechanisms in Sarbanes-Oxley, but is it in your intent that, say, for example, if I were a victim of that case or a similar case, it gives me standing for private legal action against the managers and executives of the organization?
Well,
rather than there being potentially corporate liability.
You mean if they, does the CEO, by signing this form, if in fact they had not reviewed the records, personally responsible?
Well, let me go at it from Representative Thompson's question. So say that the CEO has reviewed and signed and is comfortable with that, and then we get a situation where, for whatever reason, employee X throws the laptop in the back of the car and the same situation happens again, and say my information were on that laptop. Would I have standing? I mean, is it the intent, or implicit or explicit, that I would have standing for private legal action against the executives or the CEO of that healthcare provider?
This bill does not create a private right of action that wasn't there before. You know as well as I do that if there was a damage and the organization was going to be sued, the CEO, the chief information officer and everybody that has a pocket is going to be named in the lawsuit. But I think, in a sense, this gives protection to that, because if the breach was a result of a violation of a procedure that the CEO had approved, I think that provides some protection for the CEO. If in fact it's a problem of the procedures that the CEO has signed, attested that they've reviewed it, I think I don't know the answer. What is it? I'm not an attorney, and I don't play one on television. But
well, I just think it's an important.
Yeah, there is nothing in here that explicitly creates a private right of action.
Representative Kinnamer.
Where is the language that limits this? Is it limited to insurance companies then? Because 519 speaks about providers as well.
No, it's insurance companies and healthcare systems is the intention.
And facilities. Yeah.
Okay, that's my question. I'm still reading and find that.
It's not an individual doctor's office or something like that. It's the
wanted to make sure of that.
The organizations.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, are you aware anywhere else in the statute that requires the folks covered by this bill, either plans or providers, having to report whether there have been breaches of security in terms of health records? Because what is interesting about this is that one of the things that has to be reported is any breaches. But is there anything in statute now anywhere that says those things have to be reported? I mean, we know they do get reported. There's often public disclosure on the rather large items that become apparent. But I'm just wondering. I just don't know if there's anything else that requires them to do that kind of reporting.
I think this only requires them to report it to their board. And again, having worked in a large organization at a relatively high level, reporting something to your board is about the worst thing you can do. I mean, that, in some ways, it is going to get public, but this is really taking executive responsibility to the people that really matter to a CEO, and that's his boss, the board, his or her boss.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Is there a reason that government agencies that possess health records don't seem to be covered by this? Seems like we had a breach with the Veterans Administration. That's federal, but
huge breach. That's right.
Yeah. Was it intentional, or just it doesn't matter, or they never make mistakes, or?
No, I'm sure there's nothing in a government bureaucracy that ever causes an error.
Well, my understanding, but
no, I just think it got a big broad sweep, and I'm not sure how we would get to. But there are state agencies, and we're responsible for them. We're essentially the board of directors.
Well, we have a lot of caseworkers and people that have that kind of data potentially on laptops. I don't know what the security measures are, but
next session, we pass this section. Next session, we can take that up. I'd be happy to work with you on it. I think that's a useful thing to do. And I agree with you. I'm just, in truth, this is more of an answer to a question you didn't ask. I am really concerned about the question of expanding security in terms of the personal information of people. You're going to hear me talk about it when we're talking about if we get to talk about a prescription database. I'm worried about it in terms of large databases. For example, there are managed care programs that are sharing whole databases with the Quality Institute that we've heard before. These things make me more and more nervous, and as more and more data gets out, I am becoming more and more concerned. So I think any actions we can begin to take that will recognize that there's a problem and try to begin to chip away at how to make that data more secure, I'm going to favor, and I'm going to help anybody who's trying to do that, whether it's public or private or anybody else. It is a growing concern in my mind.
Representative Greenlick, I think your time out there has just about expired. Would you like to come back up here and resume the gaveling?
It's a lot easier down here.
We don't want you to get off too easy, sir. Get used to it.
Can he still answer questions while he's up here, or are we done with that?
No, I think he can still answer questions. He's proven that before. So, and can I invite the other people up now, or have I already given that? Okay, could we also invite, there are two people who are signed up to speak, Felissa Hagens and Gwen Dayton, could you come up?
Felissa, need to go?
Oh, so I'd be very glad to have Felissa go first. But for the record, my name is Gwen Dayton. I'm the general counsel for the Hospital Association. And I'll only speak briefly and certainly answer any questions that you might have. We do have some concerns about this bill, not because we disagree with any of the goals of the bill. Hospitals, as was illustrated by Chair Greenlich's testimony, are very concerned about security of our patient records. The consequences for the patient are significant. If there is a breach, and the consequences, frankly, for the hospital are significant. So this is something that is very high on our priority list and on our radar screen. So I think some of our concerns about the bill relate to just that. I think, well, I completely agree that our CEOs and our boards of trustees need to be fully engaged in privacy and security issues. I think because of the critical nature of these issues, that they really already are. But I also want to alert the committee to some changes in the law that have occurred in the last few years. Frankly, since the breach that Chair Greenlich referenced, there was a bill that was passed in this assembly last session, Senate Bill 583, that imposes significant privacy and security obligations on a number of folks, but certainly including hospitals, that came out of a work group that the hospitals participated in. And it does require, Representative Kotek asked if there's an obligation to notify of a breach. There is not in statute, to my knowledge, an obligation to notify internally the CEO or Board of Trustees of a hospital or other facility of a breach, but there is an obligation in law now to notify the subject of a record if there's been a significant material breach of their record. So that certainly does exist. We also have new law on the federal level. There's new, very recent changes to expansion of the HIPAA privacy and security laws that come out of the federal stimulus package. We're really just getting our arms around them. They're quite significant, and they are, I think, related to Chair Greenlich's concern about the ease of disclosure of electronic health records that we're all trying to use, that we know promotes good quality patient care, but we need to get our arms around the privacy and security issues. And so there are new obligations that we will need to adhere to. There's also a new law that goes into effect, I think, May 1st of this year, that called the red flag rules that come out of the federal government. They require anybody who holds a patient account, which would include a hospital, to have policies and procedures in place that identify red flags for identity theft. And what's significant about it, and the reason I bring it to the attention of the committee, is not only do we have to have these policies and procedures in place, but we have to have them done at the highest levels in the hospital. The CEO and the board need to be involved in the approval of these policies and procedures. So it's one effort to recognize the importance of having our upper management and the CEOs and the boards involved in these very critical issues. So that is occurring in hospitals right now. I hope that's helpful.
All that should make this much easier for them to sign the form.
Chair Greenlich, I see your point, but I think the hospital's point is that we don't know that the assurances that are required in this bill necessarily add to the protections of our patients' records, and that's our goal, and I know it's yours as well.
Yeah, so we could stipulate that you don't know that it'll make a difference, but that doesn't mean you have a problem with it, or?
Well, Chair Greenlich, I think we always have a problem when there's one more thing that we need to do that we don't necessarily think advances the cause all that much. That would be our concern.
Could I get a clear answer from you? You are,
oh, I'm
is
sorry.
The Hospital Association objecting to the fact that your CEOs will have to sign one form a year?
The Hospital Association is objecting to the fact that the CEO would be asked to sign a form that we think does not necessarily advance patient protection. Yes.
We could send a pen to every one of them. I'd be happy to chip in to do that.
Chair Greenlich, I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd just like to say I'm not as concerned about the piece of the bill where the CEO has to sign a form. I'm more attracted to the piece involving the annual report, because I think that that would go a long way to making consumers of healthcare feel more comfortable with what's happening to their records. I think that level of transparency and reporting, they know that, you know, every year they can check in with the office and see what kind of report their health system is sending in. And I think that's, and if other than the onerousness of producing a report, you know, if the association has no other objection, that I think is a reason to go forward with it. Because I think it really would bolster consumer confidence in the overall system.
Representative Bruin?
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, Representative Dembrow sort of sparked my thought on this, and the preface of the comments about, you know, the annual signature from the CEOs and the annual reporting, I mean, that's not the that's not disconcerting, and obviously I would argue that what you're trying to achieve in this bill is admirable and desirable. My question is, going back to your comments, Mr. Chair, about your concerns regarding more data out there every year and the problems that creates, and to go from what Representative Dembrow was saying with these annual reports, are we creating a situation by the public reporting, the specific public reporting of weaknesses, that we actually make the problem potentially worse by pointing out and highlighting to those who aren't acting in the system's best interest where the weak points are? And I don't know the answer to that question. I just raise it as I'd like to know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I don't know if we have the sophistication to answer it.
President Thompson?
Now, I don't want to belabor this point, but I really think if we move forward with this, we need to include government agencies in this thing. We were moving into House Bill 2009, we're creating a lot of database transfers, accumulations, and whatnot. And you know, I'd like to see what the security is on any of that. Mm-hmm. I really think asking private industry to do this, but exempting government from it, is sending a message that I really don't want to send.
I don't think we've exempted government. You mean we haven't?
They just aren't covered.
Yeah,
healthcare.
I mean, and part of it, I think we need to have a general discussion about that. I think it's a really important discussion to have.
We're going to have a lot of healthcare records involved in this health authority board.
We're building an interim agenda, and we're going to start working on that interim agenda as soon as we're closed down for real work. And I think that'd be a really important topic for, I think, the whole question of health data security, both private and governmental, yeah, is a very real question.
I'm assuming we do a very good job, but I don't know that. So,
and we'd have to get the governor to sign that one, but I don't think the governor has the same influence as a CEO of an organization has.
Oh, we have Dr. Smith here. She can sign.
Mr. Chair, to Representative Bruin's point, one of the contents of the report says all significant deficiencies in the design or operation of record-keeping systems or controls that could adversely affect the covered entity's ability to protect the confidentiality of, you know, protected information.
That's a report to the Board of Directors. Those are items that are to be reported by the CEO to the Board of Directors. Isn't that what you're talking about? Item, yeah, on page 3.
So that is not a public document.
No. See, item 3, line 32 and down, is that what we're talking about? Which says, contain assurances that the signing officer has disclosed to the Board of Directors of the facility all these things. That it simply, okay, says that these things have been reported to the Board, not publicly. And this is a...
Mr. Chair, how about line 30 on page 2, as reported to the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services? That had the same sort of non-public protection? And if it does, that's wonderful.
The intention was to have these things reported to the board, their own board, not in public.
I just don't know what's public records or not. That's more the question.
The only public record is the attestation that this occurred.
That's right.
Okay. And I would also want to ask how many times this has been publicly accessed.
Oh.
Because
it's the same. It's the same issue. The things on the lines you're talking about come under 25, and it's under C, and it's agitation. In this case, it disclosed to the auditors and to the governing board of the covered entity. These are not public disclosures.
Okay.
They're only disclosures that they have told their bosses what's happened. It seems so harmless to me. I mean, I don't see how any CEO can have a problem with this.
Mr. Chair, corporations have annual reports that they publish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're going to put anything, that would be the place to put the attestation that that they have reviewed their security procedures, et cetera, per ORS, whatever it is. I think that's going to be read by somebody that has an interest in the institution more than sending it to Oprah and Dr. Smith getting the phone call from John Q. Public saying, I want to know, because I would frankly want to know how many times that happens, because I bet it adds up to that much after 1 year.
You put those phone calls into a fiscal. Yeah, I have to say I read a lot of annual reports. And I never read those things back in the end on all those fine print. I guess
so
I should. I'm irresponsible.
So you're going to have a public information request to the director, to Oprah, because you don't even know who that is. Most people, I'm sorry, Dr. Smith, but most people don't know who.
We know her.
We know her.
Okay, I think we've had enough of this one. We're going to open it for a work session. We can talk about it again when we get, I mean, not now. We don't have a fiscal. And if any of you find ways to improve it, I'll be happy to talk about it before then. We close the public hearing on 2604. I'd like to do in the next very few minutes, before I do want to make sure we have time for the autism. Folks have come here to testify on it. I do want to open up a work session on... Do we have Arizona Co-Tech? We do. We're all here on HB 2009. For the purpose of adopting the Dash 10 amendments, and I will ask Mr. Burns to join us. He's passed out an index to it. But, Tom, I'd also like you to, if you can briefly tell us what's changed since the Dash 9s, and it's in only been things in page 6 through 6 through 30, is that
41.
Right?
41.
6 through what?
41.
6 through 41. Mr. Nesbitt, is there anything you'd like to say to us as we're going along this? Or are you? Sure. I'll let you join us.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I'm Tom Burns, serving as health policy consultant for the chair on this monster. The Dash 9 amendments have been in your hands since last week. It became clear to us that there were some technical changes that needed to be made to them. The Dash 10s reflect those changes, and I thought I'd quickly go through and highlight what those changes were. First of all,
Mr. Burns,
yes,
is this a comparison between the Dash 9 and now the Dash 10?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
And we have one copy of it. I'm going to bring it here to put on the table so we at least have it in front of us.
Yes, this is a comparison between the Dash 10s and the Dash 9s.
Thank you.
There was some concern about the word compensation when we were looking at the board. Compensation means something else in state government other than a per diem. So the board language has been changed. The board members shall set their own per diem, not compensation. There was some concern about how the Public Health Benefit Purchasers Committee interacted with some other language in the bill, specifically requiring the board to come up.
I'm sorry. Can you help us by going page number?
Yes. Just
from the 9.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Page.
We have the 10 and the 9?
We have the 10.
We have the 10. Okay.
If you tell me on the 10 where you are, that would be very helpful.
Be happy to. Mr. Chair, Rep. Maurer, what I was just referring to with the word per diem occurs on page 6, line 16 through 19. The word per diem has been inserted there twice where it originally said compensation. The next changes are over with respect to how the Public Health Benefits Purchaser Committee, which is established in Section 7, worked with Sections 9.1D and 9.2A. Both of those sections seem to be duplicative of what we had asked that the Public Health Benefit Purchasers Committee do, and so we struck 9.1D and 9.2A.
So they're not here at
they're
all?
They're not here in front of you anymore. And what one of them did was 9.1D asked the board to create a health plan and implement that plan by January of 2011. That's the same duty you gave the Public Purchasers Committee. There was some question about why we needed to do both. And 9.2A said that the board had the authority to negotiate local government contracts for health care, and it's too early to go down that path for this proposed amendment.
Mm-hmm. We listened to you.
You did.
I hope it gets us a vote down the line. We'll see.
Get a vote for sure.
The next one has to do with a publicly owned program or a publicly owned benefit program. Page 12, lines 24 through 27. There was some concern about whether that program could continue, could simply be created by the board and charge forward. As you can see, it now requires that their plan report to the legislature.
Where are we talking about, Tom?
This is page 12, lines 24 through 27. The board shall develop a publicly owned health benefit plan that operates in the exchange under the same rules and regulations and report to the legislature on that plan. So it would give you the ability to review, comment, and otherwise make changes to that plan as you felt needed. Turning to the exchange, which is now section 17 of the dash amendments. I'm sorry, is now section 17B of the dash amendments. We wanted to make it very clear that the exchange could not start until after the plan was developed and the assembly had the chance to look at it. So you will notice that 17B has been amended to strike the words that's created the exchange.
I'm sorry, what page now?
19.
I got it. Thank you.
So the exchange is no longer created, and this must be reported on page 20 for legislation to come before you. Page 20, lines 19 and 21 require the plan that's developed for the exchange must come to you.
That's always been what was intended, but the words were not very clear on that.
There was a concern in the exchange around the use of the term on page 19, line 27, identifying the role of insurance vendors. That term doesn't exist in law. It is actually purchasers. That has been cleaned up.
It says producers still.
I'm sorry, producers. The word was vendors. It's now. It should be producers. That's a recognized term in current law.
That means insurance companies?
Brokers.
Insurance brokers.
Brokers.
I got it.
The essential benefit package was accidentally left out of the dash nines. It is now section 17B that starts on page, I'm sorry, where'd it go? Sorry, not 17B. Page
LC, six, LC lost it before and you lost it now, right?
Page 16.
Section 16.
I'm sorry, section 16, yes. It defines the essential benefit package. It is section 16 that creates that essential benefit package.
Which is the baseline.
Yes, and I apologize for that. The word that went to LC was essential benefit package. It came back baseline. We can clean that up in the future. You can decide what you want to do with that as another amendment.
In the nine, you use both terms.
But it is the substance of
it is
what
we
talked
right.
about the last time.
Right. I'm also aware of a number of other policy problems that are in the Dash 9s that I can highlight to you if you are interested in them.
But they're not in the Dash 10s?
They're not. They're not in the Dash 10s. No, they didn't get fixed.
The things you found by going over the boilerplate.
Right.
Things like, he said, somebody being dropped off a board rather than
being added to the
board. Things like that. Yeah. So we've been carefully reviewing the boilerplate so we can certify to you that they are boilerplate. And in our next set of amendments, we'll get them cleaned up.
And we'll come up with a long list.
So you have now addressed the essential changes between the 9 and the 10.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
That's all I have.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just to clarify, because we are all type A personalities and we like detail, your intention today is to move the Dash 10s for the sole purpose of generating an A engrossed version of 2009. I assume we'll have an opportunity to change baseline to essential and other things next week when we revisit the A engrossed. Is that correct?
That's correct. Sure. My intention is to move, I was looking for the script, to move this to the, what's the language? Well, first we're going to adopt the amendments, and then we're going to move the bill without recommendation to the floor with a
motion to return it to with the recommendation to be returned back to us
to passage, and the bill be referred
and the bill be referred back to us.
Correct, Mr. Chair. I think the comfort
the
level of everybody.
The only function is to get an A and grow so we can really see what it all looks like.
Right.
And we'll be dealing with a set of amendments next week that will be amendments to the A and grossed.
Exactly. And I just wanted to clarify that for everyone on the committee for comfort level in terms of, I think all of us would be in agreement that we would benefit from an A and gross, and I hope we could all get there today on that issue at least.
Well, so. I think it's beyond just the committee, it's for the public, because quite
Absolutely.
Frankly the public
yeah,
doesn't
no,
know
this, yeah.
what I mean they're back on 2009 original
absolutely
and
yeah.
we're version 300.
That's right. When we have A and gross, then it's online and it's in its full form, and we expect to have that on Friday.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up question to Representative Kotak's point in question. We'll engross the bill, but we'll continue to walk through what in effect the Dash 10s, which will be in the bill, we'll continue to walk through in sort of a working work session format. So with these various word changes, I mean, it's not to report back to Tom on an individual basis, just to discuss it at the dais.
Well, correct? I think there are two sets of things we want to do, and one is we want to get a sort of omnibus list of things that are just, this isn't what we intended, it's just the benefit, the baseline benefit, meaning essential benefit. A list of those things, I think it would be great if you just dealt with those with Tom.
So okay.
Because there'll be at the end a cleanup amendment, and
that's
and
my
it
question.
Will,
okay,
it will do
thank
those
you, Mr.
kind
Chair.
Of things. We'll talk about any substantive changes that are in 10. It would be useful if we know what those are. We'll talk about those. Substantive changes that are in the A engrossed version. But we'll also then be talking about additions to the A engrossed version, including, I believe, we're going to consider the four governor's bills that passed out of the Senate committee to the Ways and Means yesterday. And my intention, I thought it was an agreement that I had with the Senate, is we will probably amend those into the final version of 2009. Yes. Mr. Nesbitt, would you just like to comment on where we are and the governor's staff view of...
Very much so. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, Deputy Chief of Staff of the Governor, and appreciate the opportunity. We've been coming forward with comments about a lot of the details of the bill, and I think it might be appropriate for me to give you our overview. As well as maybe talk about some other details which haven't been as obvious. First, appreciate all the work going into this, and we obviously support the goals and objectives of the bill, and in particular we support moving forward with the Dash 10 amendments to create that A engrossed version we can work from hereafter. Most importantly, we think the bill has all the tools that will be needed to turn a report, namely large parts of the Oregon Health Fund Board report, into a plan, and a plan into reality. And so we appreciate all of the detail here and the fact that it offers a pathway to implement in sequence step-by-step programs and mechanisms and reforms needed to make healthcare affordable and effective and accessible to all Oregonians, which is the whole purpose. With those 1,000 pages, we haven't had a chance to review them all, and we too have our list of items for that omnibus list of things you mentioned, Mr. Chair, but I won't go over them right now. We've been working closely with you and your staff on those, and appreciate the attention to them. And I do want to point out the governor does support the creation of a health authority to take responsibility for implementing the best next steps to these comprehensive health care reform goals. And we also appreciate the programmatic focus that the health authority will create for the divisions of DHS that will be brought under its scope. In this, we've been guided by the assessments of Dr. Goldberg, and who assures us that the realignment of programs and entities is feasible and will provide that focus that we need. And likewise, we've been guided by the assessments of the director of DCBS, Corey Streisinger, who's called your attention to a number of issues that need to be clarified, and I think a lot of them have been already, so we appreciate that.
Dr. Goldberg is busy answering four questions tonight in a different context.
Or else he would be here, that's true. I do want to call your attention to this whole question of feasibility. I think there's wisdom in setting a December 2010 deadline for completion of the plans, as you've done. That sets up a checkpoint or a check-in point with the 2011 Legislative Assembly. And we think this will be important for bringing to fruition the insurance exchange and the consideration of the public plan option. Further, there are critical timelines in the bill for the exercise of the authority's duties and the implementation of the coverage expansion for children and low-income adults, sections 24 through 34 in particular. And these timelines will be feasible if the funding they require is feasible in 2009-11 and beyond. So DHS is committed to working with you and with LFO to nail down those costs and funding requirements. But there's also work to be done to construct a least cost, least disruption approach to the reorganization of DHS, including the cost effectiveness of separating the Medicaid programs, medical and long-term care components. As you mentioned, there may be other pieces coming to you from the Senate that will have to be worked in as well. So I want to mention that DHS is ready to work with you on this and come up with the best way to transition to the full-fledged authority that that you envision to allow you to kind of create that most effective, least cost approach to the reorganization, which is a major, major piece of this. We appreciate all the work being done to accommodate the children's health care provisions, which I understand will be in Section 26. And just one other caution, I'm assuming...
I think we have that language wired down now, I think.
Good. Yeah, I think we do. And my comments don't go to the provider tax sections of this bill because that's dependent on the outcome of the legislative work group. But just one other question that's hanging out there. If and when those that tax piece was to come into this bill and move forward with this bill in its final form, we want to make sure that attention is paid to what can have an emergency clause and what can't. We've heard different opinions of that. It's just something to be nailed down because, obviously, if you have a revenue-raising piece in this bill, it's going to have a later implementation date. And the other pieces of this bill, which have earlier effective dates, we're going to have to reconcile with that. But again, thank you very much for all the work going into this. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Mr. Nesbitt raises a very important question, and it's at the end. One of the things that LC has told us is we'll try and figure out, we will probably have different implementation dates for different sections of the bill, and that needs to be in the final amendment. And you're right, it does depend whether the tax is here or in 2116. The tax will go forward in one of those two mechanisms. But, yeah, there are other issues here that LC has reminded us we need to work through. Thank you. Are there any questions, Mr. Nesbitt?
Oh, ma'am. Ma'am?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
Let's try and hold it, though, short.
Very short.
We've got people here that are here to testify.
Mr. Nesbitt, one of the concerns, I'm not involved in the tax discussions, And one of the concerns I have is on the DHS cut list, the 30%. The very top of that list is there are two reductions. Number one is a reduction on the increase that was promised to hospitals of reimbursement. And five lines down is a further reduction down to what the governor's recommended budget was, which was 72% reimbursement or 72% of cost. And that concerns me that we're promising the hospitals increased reimbursement to essentially help, maybe not hold them totally harmless, but help them in that process so that we don't disrupt services to massive numbers of Oregonians. But on the back end, we're now going to gut that, and that is, to me, is very troubling.
I'll take that question and save Mr. Nesbitt an official position on this. Basically, the hospital provider tax in its current form runs out in
October 1st.
On October 1st. So at that point, there is no hospital provider tax. But we are required under the stimulus package to keep the 24,000 or whatever number of those people on. The only possible way, if we don't get a new hospital provider tax, is to cut the reimbursement rates. So that, we hope we don't have to face any of those things in the 30% cut list, but the fact is there will not be any other way if we have not worked out another provider tax except to cut reimbursement. Having said that, it is very clear that where the hospital tax negotiations are going is really related to both a tax and the reimbursement of hospitals for the next, at least for the next biennium, and that, I can assure you, is where those negotiations are going. Negotiations are being, my understanding of them is that they are including the whole hospital reimbursement, not just the hospital reimbursement
standard.
It'll be on the whole health plan population. So those negotiations are actively involved, and I'm sure you've heard about them from your administrators on and off. You want to add anything to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Maurer, I'm not involved in the work group, so I trust the report you
completely
got from Representative Greenlick. Obviously, you'll construct a provider tax bill and you'll construct a budget, and those two will answer the question. But we certainly hope, as I reported in my earlier testimony some time ago, that we'll see a bill and a budget that draws down that $1 billion in unused federal matching funds, and that'll help to actually increase reimbursement levels over where they are now for the entire OHP population.
Okay.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Maurer for the question, and I just want to assure you that the hydraulics between potentially renewing and expanding one assessment, the provider tax, to do more around the health plan is being very carefully considered in conjunction with the budgetary choices around the 30% reduction list. You raise very good points. We're aware of the interaction and making sure we don't, you know, do something that could detrimentally affect either one of those efforts. So I just want to thank you for raising the issue, but I also want to assure you that we understand there's a relationship there and we're paying attention to it.
Okay.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I have a motion, Representative Parker.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the LC-10 amendments dated April 8th of 2009 to House Bill 2009.
Representative Harker moves the -10 amendments to House Bill 2009. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Representative Harker?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2009 as amended without recommendation as to passage and that the bill be referred to the House Health Care Committee.
Is there any discussion? This is my fourth term in the legislature, and it's the first time I've ever heard of this maneuver. So it was designed for us by the Legislative Council and the Chief Clerk.
Apparently they did it on the land use bill last session.
Ah, okay.
FYI.
Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Excused.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries.
Could we get the chair to sign an affidavit on this that he has reviewed the procedure and knows this to be a legal maneuver?
I will sign that affidavit and the final passage of the bill, which means I will also have put my eyes on all thousand. Well, this won't be a thousand pages. Right now, I've been relying on a good staff who's worried about a CEO, and I do that really does take me to comment on, once again, both the work that Tom Burns has done and the work Lori Freeman has done from the Legislative Council office. Has been quite extraordinary work, and a bunch of folks from the governor's staff, a bunch of the advocates have been working very hard. We're not done with it yet, but we've come a long way with it. I will close the work session on House Bill 2009. I will announce we're carrying over House Bill 2435. To Friday, we expect we'll have a good report on it and maybe a fiscal, and we'll be able to move it out. And I'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3000. And I lost the list. We'll find it here. We have no idea how much paper we have in front of us.
And you'll need to get this going. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I need the bill.
We're going to get somebody on the phone, is that right?
No.
Okay, why don't we?
I'm going to go first and get somebody on the phone.
I'm sorry?
I'm going to testify first and then someone on the phone.
I think we're going to get Gina Green on the phone, is that?
Second, if that's okay.
That's just fine.
Okay.
That's, in fact, that's where she is.
Perfect.
And you're going to pronounce your last name for us.
Unum.
Unum, that's easy. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Unum. I'm the parent of an 8-year-old son with autism. I'm also an attorney.
Go ahead and go.
I'm formerly with the United States Department of Justice. I also was a law professor at George Washington University Law School in Washington, D.C.
Can we have those lights up just a little?
Kind of like the mood lighting in here.
Yeah. You don't want to put any of your committee members to sleep.
No, I don't. You're right.
Go ahead, please.
I gave up my legal career to advocate full-time on behalf of children with autism when I saw the inequity in the insurance arena. So now I'm senior counsel with Autism Speaks, a national research and advocacy nonprofit. And I just want to add at the outset that my testimony is a bit longer than any of the other supporters of this bill.
Well, if we need to, we'll try and go till about 5:15 to make sure everybody's heard.
Thank you. Autism is a medical condition brought on through no fault of the family. It is diagnosed by a medical doctor, and treatment is prescribed by a medical doctor. You see on the slide before you the umbrella category of pervasive developmental disorder, which has 5 distinct diagnoses. The 3 that are purple are considered the autism spectrum disorders. The most commonly prescribed treatment protocol involves a therapy called Applied Behavior Analysis, or ABA for short. Parents call it ABA therapy. This is a therapy that has been used for many decades to treat children with autism, and yet the insurance industry continues to deny coverage for ABA therapy, often on the basis that it is experimental. That self-serving conclusion is simply not supported by the science. The Surgeon General, the National Research Council, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and many other medical organizations have endorsed the use of ABA therapy for children with autism. The Mayo Clinic put out a report.
Sorry, excuse me. Who were those organizations, please?
The Surgeon General, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Research Council.
Would you these guys make those documents available to us?
I would be happy to. In fact, let me read you a quote from the American Academy of Pediatrics study put out in 2007. It says, the effectiveness of ABA-based intervention in autism spectrum disorders has been well documented through 5 decades of single-subject methodology and in controlled studies of comprehensive early intensive behavioral intervention programs in university and community settings. Children who receive early intensive behavioral treatment have been shown to make substantial, sustained gains in IQ, language, academic performance, and adaptive behavior, as well as some measures of social behavior, and their outcomes have been significantly better than those in control groups. And I was also mentioning the Mayo Clinic put out a study in 2006, which says decades worth of scientific research provide clear and convincing support for the technique referred to as applied behavior analysis. Now, studies show that if ABA therapy is administered intensively and by properly trained therapists, approximately half of the children will overcome their autistic characteristics to the extent that they can enter first grade indistinguishable from their peers. And the other half, who don't have this best outcome, still make significant gains such that they need fewer supports for the rest of their lives.
And you have that study for us as well. It would be useful to see that.
I do. I would be happy to provide that as well.
Be great. Thank you.
Certainly. As I mentioned, though, ABA must be administered intensively, often 40 hours per week. This, of course, makes it quite expensive. My own son's autism is very severe. He is diagnosed with the most severe of the 3 autism spectrum disorders, autistic disorder, and he is on the severe end of that. Oh, this is advancing by itself.
You're moving ahead there.
It went without me. My own son's autism has cost us $75,000 per year out of pocket. Now, most children's therapy programs don't cost that much, but some, the few truly severe children, do cost that much. My husband and I are lucky because we're blessed with good jobs and we've been able to make sacrifices to afford this therapy for our son. We're both lawyers. We had to sell our house and move to a less expensive house so that we could get this therapy for our son. But I ask you, how many Oregon families do you know who would be able to make that kind of financial sacrifice to get this therapy for their child? Even if they're willing. I know these families out here would be willing to do it, but you have to have a house to sell or a salary to sacrifice in order to get it. Most, of course, cannot do that, and of course, most of those children are simply going untreated. I think it's sad that in the United States of America, we know of a treatment that works for this disorder, and yet if your parents are not wealthy, you can't get it. And it's unfair, given that these are families who are paying insurance premiums.
Excuse me, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just since we're talking about the cost per year, I mean, one of the reasons that I signed on to this bill is because there's a cap in the annual amount that can be spent. Do you think the cap that's in the bill is a realistic amount?
The cap is going to leave some children like my own getting about a 50% benefit, but I understand the concerns, and, you know, $36,000 is better than nothing. I'll put it that way.
Okay, thank you.
But, you know, it's not only sad, it is unfair when you've got families who are paying insurance premiums every month. They're doing what we ask families to do. They're buying insurance for their family to insure against exactly this kind of unforeseen and unprovoked medical disaster. There's a 2006 Harvard study from the School of Public Health that found that if a child with autism is not properly treated, the societal cost for that one child is $3.2 million over his or her lifetime. In addition, a 1998 study for the state of Pennsylvania projected an actual cost savings to the state of over $1 million per child. Now, you and I, y'all can do the math just as well as I can. If you take the national prevalence figures of 1 in 150, just to be on the conservative side, you've got 1 in 150 kids diagnosed with autism. Only the wealthy, lucky few are getting the treatment that their doctors prescribe. And take all the rest of them and multiply them by over $1 million per child. You know, it's that's how much Oregon taxpayers are going to have to shell out if these kids don't get the treatment that their doctors are prescribing. And I caution you, lest you think, well, we'll just handle them in our budget the same way we've always handled this population. Think again, because with a prevalence rate of 1 in 150 today, you know, 20 years ago, the prevalence rate was about 1 in 10,000. And we don't know, scientists don't know or agree upon the reason for this dramatic increase, but there's one thing that is certain. There is an autism tsunami that is going to hit the state of Oregon and hit your budget. And it's going to cost a heck of a lot of money in special education and adult care services, institutionalization, if these kids don't get treatment. Now, faced with this reality, 9 other states now require insurers to play their part. 8 states have passed this legislation or something very similar in the last 2 years. This keeps going ahead without me. South Carolina and Texas passed it in 2007. Arizona, Florida, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and Illinois passed it last year. And New Mexico's bill was just signed into law by Governor Richardson last week. Indiana passed a similar bill 8 years ago in 2001, which was the same year that the Attorney General of Minnesota settled a lawsuit with that state's major insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield, to require coverage for autism, including ABA therapy. And 25 other states are considering similar legislation right now this spring. Now, one of the reasons that I'm here today, you may be able to tell from my accent that I'm not from here. I worked on the legislation in South Carolina that started this recent movement toward coverage, and I have seen it successfully implemented. Children who have never before been able to receive treatment are now making remarkable progress. Providers have joined networks, they've negotiated satisfactory reimbursement rates, and I can tell you that despite the doomsday predictions from the insurance industry, no insurers have fled the state, no businesses have thrown in the towel because of this benefit. In fact, I called the Indiana Department of Insurance, which is the state that has had the law in effect for the longest, to ask what the impact on premiums had been, and they told me it had been unmeasurable even years after passage. The insurance industry's own trade association, the Council for Affordable Health Insurance, now I do want to move forward, there we go, puts out a report every year called Health Insurance Mandates in the States, and they go through all of the different mandated benefits.
Excuse me a moment, Ms. Green?
Yes.
Dr. Green, we're going to have you on a bit. There's some testimony going on
okay.
in advance. You can listen in on it, and then we'll
sure.
invite you.
So the Council for Affordable Health Insurance put out this report last year. This is an excerpt from the 2008 report showing what different mandated benefits have cost in terms of premium increase. So you can see alcoholism, they estimate between 1 and 3%. In vitro fertilization, 3 to 5%. Well, look at autism. Their own trade association says that the mandated benefits have cost less than 1%, and we don't even know how much less than 1%. And Autism Speaks, the nonprofit for which I work, engaged a private independent actuarial firm to do a study on these bills that have been introduced this year, and he also, that actuary also came up with less than 1%. Now, the insurance industry will say that such a bill will raise premiums 2 to 3% or even more, and will tell you that for every 1% premium increase, 5,500 people will lose their insurance. Before you fall for that, I ask you to hold their feet to the fire on these predictions of a devastating premium increase. Ask to see their studies, or better yet, ask for the actual claims data, because as you saw from the map, insurers in Minnesota and Indiana have been providing this coverage, including ABA therapy, for 8 years. They have been tracking this data for 8 years, and they know exactly what it costs to provide this benefit. So if they wanted to support their assertions with actual claims data, they could do so. In states where the law has passed, the overall impact on the economy has been positive, particularly in terms of job creation. Thousands of people have been trained as therapists to work with these children and are now employed full-time working with kids with autism. Now, so maybe you're convinced, okay, we need to help these kids. But you might be asking yourself, well, don't the schools provide this therapy, or shouldn't the schools provide it?
Well, as I mentioned at the outset, autism is a medical condition that is diagnosed by a medical doctor. It's not diagnosed by a school principal. It's not a learning disability. Federal law does not charge the schools with ameliorating a child's medical condition. It charges the schools with providing the child a meaningful education. Under IDEA, the federal law, schools must accommodate disabilities in the course of educating children, but schools do not, cannot, and should not be tasked with treating the disabling condition itself. For example, schools accommodate a child with diabetes by allowing the child to receive insulin injections at school, but we don't ask for the school to pay for the insulin so that that child can then learn. Now, some of the schools, of course, use these behavior techniques in their teaching, but ABA is based on one-on-one intervention, so it is incredibly expensive for the schools to do so. And furthermore, even to the extent that a school district is very well-funded and has plentiful resources, the school therapist would only work on educational goals for the child. That's the way a child's IEP is written under the federal IDEA. So children with autism would still need additional therapy at home to acquire skills such as potty training, dressing, eating, how to use utensils, toothbrushing, bathing, and other daily living skills that typical children acquire naturally through imitation. This is what children with autism have to be taught. You also might be wondering, well, can't we do this through Medicaid? A few states have tried to do it through Medicaid. They've passed autism-specific Medicaid waivers that provide ABA therapy. The problem with this is the state has to fund it. And even with federal matching dollars, no state has been able to fund a Medicaid waiver at an adequate rate so that they don't have hundreds or thousands of children on a waiting list. And as you know, with autism, if children languish on a waiting list for many years, which is what we see happening in those states, the window for maximum recovery lessens.
I want to warn you about the time.
Okay, final point. You might also hear or wonder, well, don't some insurers already cover autism? I've heard this said, well, we cover autism. Here's the problem. Even to the extent that the insurance policies don't exclude autism or do cover autism, they don't cover the treatment that is most effective and most prescribed for autism. You know, they might not have a blanket exclusion. I've included the pages with a yellow tab here. Here's an example of a Cigna policy that does have a blanket exclusion for ABA therapy. It just simply says, Cigna does not cover this procedure because we consider it experimental, investigational, or unproven. But even to the extent that policies do cover autism, if they're not covering the single most effective prescribed recommended treatment, then what's the point? It would be like if your policy said, well, we cover cancer, rest assured, you're fine, we cover cancer. But then when you get cancer, the insurer says, well, we don't cover chemotherapy. We never said we cover any particular treatment. And Chairman Greenlee, that gets to your earlier question from when the hearing started. We've been forced to go to the legislatures to ask for coverage of a particular treatment because notwithstanding all the science backing up ABA therapy, the insurers refuse to update their policies to reflect that. And so if the doctors, Johns Hopkins diagnosed my child and said, go out and get ABA therapy 40 hours a week right away. The Mayo Clinic makes this recommendation. All of the best hospitals and medical providers are prescribing ABA therapy, and yet the insurers will not update their policies to cover it. So our hands have been forced to asking the legislatures to do so. You know, I was a law professor for 7 years, and I spent a lot of that time thinking about this issue because my own son was diagnosed during the time I was teaching. And I really took a broad approach of, should this be an educational issue? Should it be a Medicaid, a state problem? And I think they all have a role to play, and they're trying. But the insurance industry is not at the table. It's the insurance industry that is least doing its part. So I urge you to please give favorable consideration to this bill and provide children in Oregon the opportunities for treatment that children in other states are now getting. Thank you for your time.
Any questions? I do have one. I do have one. Have you had a chance to read the Oregon Health Resources Commission report on the scientific evidence?
I've skimmed it, yes.
It doesn't seem to back up the kind of assertions you've made in your testimony. Do you have a
Yes, I agree that it doesn't, and I guess from my legal background, what I know is that you can find a study to say just about anything you want it to say.
But that's not fair. This is the official body of the state designed to use rigorous techniques on evaluating the research findings on a particular disease, and this is one of a number of things they've done. So the notion that you can dismiss it by saying you can find a study that says anything.
Well,
I would say that about your discussion as well.
Right. I don't mean to be disparaging toward the study, but what I would say is that many other states, TRICARE, the military insurance covers this, have examined the body of evidence as well, and have determined that it is sufficiently evidence-based. And I think Dr. Green, who is on the phone, can do a better job answering that question than
Great.
I can. But, again, the American Academy of Pediatrics examined the body of evidence as well and has endorsed ABA.
And TRICARE is cheap, so they're not going to do anything that's...
TRICARE is cheap.
Is it
a military background?
A TRICARE military. Yeah.
Well, TRICARE really examined this issue for a number of years before launching into providing this benefit, but they have been covering ABA therapy for a number of years now following examination.
Thank you. Dr. Green, I think you're up. Would you please introduce yourself?
Yes. Hi, I'm Gina Green. I'm here in San Diego. I'm a behavior analyst who's been working in autism treatment and research for a number of years and has been working on some of these legislative and public policy issues around insurance for the last couple of years. Shall I just plunge right ahead?
Please plunge right ahead. And
okay.
You want to announce? Hold on a second. I think we have your presentation available. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Impact.
And we also have, I think, an additional piece to that before us, so we've got your slides.
Okay. Well, I understand that I have pretty serious time constraints here, so I'm just going to jump to some of the main points. And I was just listening in on the question to Ms. Unum and understand there is a question about the scientific evidence supporting ABA. So I thought I would start there. And just for a little bit of background, behavior analysis, as you read in my slides, is a natural science of behavior. And so like other sciences, it has developed research methods that are appropriate to its particular subject matter. Some of those research methods include direct observation and measurement of behavior, because behavior is what we're interested in studying and in changing and in improving. We're also focused on, by definition, individual behavior as it unfolds over time and interacting with the environment. And so our research methodology, research designs, are what are referred to as single-case research designs or within-subject designs that are specifically true experiments, rigorous experimental designs when done properly, where individual participants' behavior is studied intensively under both control and treatment conditions. And in the term single case is a little bit of a misnomer in that while the focus is on individual behavior, there are often more than one participant in these studies. You can replicate the studies across any number of participants and then aggregate data across them. The focus in this scientific approach is on clinically significant changes in individual behavior. Is the person's condition better improved over their baseline or control condition or status? So it's not the traditional kind of group design study where you have a group of people who get a treatment, another group that does not, and then there's some comparison of average scores of some measure from each of those groups compared statistically. You can make a strong case that the average score on some measure of a group really doesn't tell you anything about what happened to the individual members in that group. And comparing mathematical abstractions like group averages statistically, again, doesn't give you very much information about how each person in the group did or did not respond to the treatment. So there's growing recognition of the benefits of these within subject or single case designs. They are now included in a number of protocols for developing evidence-based practice guidelines, and in fact have been adapted, at least one type of a single case design has been adapted by medical researchers. They tend to refer to them as N of one research designs. And some leaders of the evidence-based medicine movement, such as Gordon Guyatt, have picked up these designs and, in fact, view them as superior to the typical between-groups randomized clinical trials.
We don't need to get into a research methodology discussion here, but I think that's a slightly overstated case that N of one is superior to randomized clinical trials of groups. That, I mean, I would be happy to have that discussion with you offline.
Well, there's a reference on my slide to the exact source of that information. And again, there are different approaches to science, there are different approaches to research. Randomized clinical trials actually have a number of disadvantages when it comes to extrapolating from them to the individual client or patient, and that is what these folks in evidence-based practice and medicine, rather, have recognized and why they are touting N of one studies. But those are the foundation of what we do today in applied behavior analysis intervention for people with autism. Rests on literally hundreds of studies using these rigorous single-case experimental designs to evaluate a lot of specific applied behavior analysis techniques for improving functioning, for increasing functioning in virtually all areas, and also for reducing problem behaviors that put people with autism at a pretty serious risk. Their health and safety is jeopardized by those behaviors. And there's ample evidence, again, a number of independent reviews and meta-analyses demonstrating the effectiveness of APA methods for dealing with those problem behaviors. The intervention, the thesis or model, I would say, of APA treatment that probably most people have heard about is combining a model that combines many of those evidence-based specific techniques into a package and into a comprehensive program for youngsters with autism where all of their skill deficits, behavioral difficulties, and so on are addressed in a very intensive way. And so these are the studies that have gotten the most attention, I would say, in the last 10 years or so. These are children generally under the age of 6 receiving 25 to 40 hours a week of highly individualized ABA intervention. It can be done in a variety of settings, but typically with little ones, it generally begins in the home. Again, it's a very dynamic, very, very individualized approach with the goal for each and every child of helping them develop skills that will improve their functioning, keep them safe, healthy, and successful, not just in the short run, but also in the long run. There have now been a number of studies on this early, intensive, comprehensive model of ABA treatment, and you see them summarized beginning in my slide number 9. The first group to do this kind of intervention and to document the effectiveness, of course, was the UCLA group, Ivar Lobos and his colleagues. They have now published at least 7 controlled studies, and then other behavior analysts have published now 4 studies.
Dr. Green, we have 15 minutes and 5 more people who wish to testify, so
okay.
If you could wrap
just
it up.
Jump up to the, you look at slide 10, the main findings from these studies have demonstrated that applied behavior analysis comprehensive, intensive, early intervention produces substantial improvements, much more than typical treatment, eclectic intervention, and lower intensity ABA treatment in all of these areas. And in many children produces large enough improvements that they are able to function just about normally, with very little ongoing help, specialized help from that 6 or 7, 8 years old on. Other children make more modest gains, but still are doing better than if they had not received that treatment. Other interventions, even done with similar intensity, one-to-one, same number of hours, have produced minimal effects. In fact, children have actually regressed in some studies. I just wanted to point out that there have been a couple of recent meta-analyses of research on early intensive ABA for autism. I am familiar with the commission report that was done there in Oregon. I do believe that there have been more studies since that time, and there are the meta-analyses I'm going to talk about just for a second here incorporated the more recent studies and did a much more thorough and informed evaluation of the research. One of them published recently in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders, you see summarized on slide 12, did find, and again, meta-analysis methods, I am not an expert on those, but they do provide an unbiased way of aggregating data across studies and determining what size effect might have been produced by an intervention. And so in this meta-analysis, the authors...
I'm just going to have to ask you to end this testimony. We have several other people who want to testify. Could you send us any of that material? It would be very useful.
The actual studies, both of the meta-analyses, one is summarized there on page 12, on slide 12, the other more recent one on slide 13. Both of them found clear evidence that intensive ABA produces moderate to large effects in improving the functioning of children with autism and recommend that it be the intervention of choice. I can send you both of those meta-analysis papers if you'd like.
Thank you, I would.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Would you like to stay on and listen for...
I'd love to, if that's okay.
Okay. Who's next, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa McHenry. My husband, John McHenry, and I are a small business owner in Milwaukee, Oregon. As a matter of fact, my husband has been a small business owner for over 25 years in the state of Oregon. We have a strong belief in providing health care for all of our employees. So as rare as it sounds, we pay 100% of all health care costs for all of the employees in our office. In 2004, Pacific Source Health Plan sold us a group policy which costs $2,300 per month for all of our employees. $1,200 of that covers myself, my husband, and our four children. This is our son, Joseph. In 2006, our son Joseph received a medical diagnosis of autism. As proactive parents, we sought out the best medical care available and received several prescriptions for ABA therapy, applied behavioral analysis therapy. From the onset of Joseph's diagnosis, we received denial after denial from Pacific Source for speech, occupational, and ABA therapies we provided for Joseph. For nearly 3 years now, we have spent countless hours and days exhausting our efforts to get therapy for our son. We are still paying Pacific Source our premiums every month. We have spent $60,000 out of pocket for Joseph's ABA therapy since 2007. We have now exhausted the appeals process at Pacific Source. Unquestionably, Joseph needs ABA therapy, and he's receiving about 50% of the therapy that he needs due to our financial inability to pay any more than we already are or access the health care that we pay for every month. His pediatrician, as well as other medical professionals, continue to prescribe ABA therapy for him. He's made great strides in the last 27 months, but needs much more to treat his symptoms and behaviors. We've exhausted our financial and emotional resources. Besides the severe financial burden we've endured, we have spent precious time away from our other three children that we will never get back just to deal with our health care crisis. Joseph's three siblings have been and are being robbed of opportunities that we could have and they could have if we didn't have the strain on our family. In summary, Pacific Source acknowledges our policy covers the diagnosis of autism. I stand here today and ask why I cannot have access to the therapy needed to treat our son's diagnosis. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and other distinguished members of the committee. I come before you today to share my story as an insurance agency owner, city council president from the city of Sherwood, and primarily as a father of an 8-year-old son that has almost fully recovered from his...
Please state your name for
the... I'm sorry, Dave Hieronymus. Father of an 8-year-old son that has almost fully recovered from his autism spectrum disorder. As an insurance producer for the past decade, I have sold all lines of insurance to my clients, auto, home, health, and life, among others. And the common message that the clients wanted to hear from me and my company is that the policy that they were purchasing would take care of them if some unfortunate event occurred. I always thought that this contractual promise to be true until I had to deal with our own group health insurance carrier for the care of my son. When my 3-year-old son was diagnosed by a neurological pediatrician 5 years ago, I was given an action plan of treatment that involved a variety of therapies. I immediately contacted my health insurance carrier to discuss how to proceed and was bluntly told that this condition was not covered by the plan. Not medically necessary, the claims representative said to me. Not covered, I thought to myself. How can this be? This is a medical condition diagnosed by a medical doctor, and somehow a particular diagnosis is singled out and not covered by a policy. Cancer, leukemia, multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, diabetes, countless other afflictions are all covered. Why not autism? After fighting with the insurance companies for a while, my wife and I decided to move forward with the aggressive treatments, as every expert has told us that the earlier the intervention begins, the better the results. We spent the next 4 years taking our son to various providers and paying thousands out of pocket for treatments that have greatly improved our son's quality of life. He went from being nonverbal and unable to be left alone outside the home to now achieving a grade level appropriate vocabulary, attending a mainstream classroom with an aide for only 30 minutes a day versus his previous school years where he had a full day aide. And he loves going to school to the point where even when he has a bad cold, he still wants to go. Lastly, as a city councilor in Sherwood for the last 10 years, the one thing I've learned is that our constituents expect us to show leadership and take action on a variety of issues. The bottom line was that our citizens appreciated the fact that we always took on a topic, held public hearings, open houses to gather the information that we needed, and then make a decision, yes or no. That's what politicians and elected officials are sent to office to do. This issue was already raised in the 2007 session. An autism work group was created and gathered information during 2008. And now here we are again discussing a bill that would not even take effect for over 2 years. Delaying or inaction on an important issue such as this is not in the public's best interest when the issue has already been thoroughly vetted. I am here today for those families who have yet to begin this journey. We ask you, our elected leaders, to remove one of the roadblocks that will help keep these families from financial ruin and to provide the insurance coverage for the therapies they need to improve their child's quality of life. All of us here today ask that you move forward House Bill 3000 out of committee and for a vote to the full House. Thousands of Oregon children are depending on you for action on this important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. You did notify insurance company that the disease was covered. We did that in 2007 to make sure.
This was the diagnosis back in 2004.
Yeah. We took care of that in 2007, that it is covered, but only for the things that are usually covered. So the issue here is to add the particular therapies and diagnosis.
Right, I agree, but there are some people that are falling through the cracks that I think that Absolutely. We need to strengthen the bill.
I also do want to point out to the committee and simply for the record that if we mandate this, we're not mandating it for everybody. We're mandating it for about 40% of the population that's covered by
right. I realize that it's a small step in the right direction.
Yeah. It's just that when we went to mental health parity, we disappointed a lot of people who were in self-insured plans and others who found out that mental health parity didn't relate to them. It related only to a segment of the. But it's a segment you deal with every day.
Every day.
Yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Christopher Delfs, and when I was 2.5 years old, I was diagnosed with autism. I don't remember much about the treatment they gave me, except that I did ABA. There was a lot of one-on-one intervention, and I remember some of the names of the people that did that for me. And after that, I did two preschools a day, for about 2 years, one in the morning and one in the afternoon for a social aspect. And then in kindergarten, I also did AM, PM. And then I graduated the ABA when I was about 5. And I really don't think I'd be where I am today if I had done that. Because right now I think I'm doing very well compared to the way I was doing back then. As my parents paid for the ABA out of pocket. Because now I get good grades, I play basketball, and I'm doing track. I'm missing a practice right now. I play tuba for...
It's an educational process.
Yeah. And daily doubles tomorrow, Mr. Chair.
And I play tuba for the Metropolitan Youth Symphony up in Portland in their band and orchestra. And I'm planning on going to a college that can provide my interests. I consider myself a lucky case because my parents were able to pay for this treatment, and I believe that it did work very well on me, even though I do not remember much about it. Thank you.
Chris, do you get special accommodation in high school?
No.
You're doing remarkable, and thank you very much for being here. It's an inspiration to hear stories of people who struggled for so long.
He didn't ask the question. He's fully capable of...
Oh, he clearly is. I asked him the question I wanted to ask him, and he's done great. Are there any other questions to Chris?
I think you could have the coach call us if you need an excuse.
Yeah, okay. We'll write the note.
We're not done yet. Thank you very much for coming. Jake, are you still here?
Yep.
Come on. While we're talking, will you enter that into the record?
Yes, we have written testimony from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield dated April 8th, 2009, relating to the testimony on House Bill 3000.
Mike, you want to comment on it at all or just put in the record?
Just on the record.
Thank you, sir.
Jake Oakenberg, Government Relations Consultant, Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Portland, Oregon. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Harker and Maurer, members of the Healthcare Committee, I appreciate you holding this hearing today on autism spectrum disorder and House Bill 3000. This is an issue that is special interest for me. My father has been a psychiatrist at Kaiser for over 30 years, and my mother is a pediatric social worker at Kaiser, and she's managed the developmental assessment clinic for ages 0 to 5 for the last 25 years. I've seen firsthand the autism explosion and the burgeoning need for effective assessment and treatment for ASD. At Kaiser, we followed the Autism Spectrum Disorder Workgroup during the interim. We gave input for the preliminary findings and attended outreach meetings. We also read the Oregon Health Resources Commission ASD treatment report, released in October, a report requested by the 2007 legislature. In light of the evidence presented by both groups, House Bill 3000 seems to be putting the cart before the horse. In the words of the Health Resources Commission, the majority of the research studies looking at ASD treatment interventions have significant limitations and most show insufficient evidence. Oregon's legislature has recognized the importance of making evidence-based medical decisions, but House Bill 3000 creates a specific exception for one condition, ASD, an exception for specific treatments such as applied behavior analysis, that is noted by your own commission study lack sufficient evidence on their efficacy. The commission report also noted, however, that the lack of evidence of effectiveness does not equate to known ineffectiveness of an intervention. With that in mind, at Kaiser, we are doing universal screening of young children using the ages and stages questionnaire actually 4 times before 36 months, and we are glad to see your work with the governor to establish the Oregon Commission on ASD. We are committed to helping this new commission, and we're eager to continue providing our medical expertise on this bill, as well as any other legislation you may consider on autism spectrum disorder. Thank you.
Jake, I have a question. What does Kaiser do once they diagnose somebody as likely being on the spectrum?
The one of the good pieces about the ages and stages questionnaire is that it now allows an immediate referral to early intervention. Not only in Multnomah County, we've worked out a similar deal across the river in Vancouver, in Clark County, without having to do a reassessment to get, with the limited programs that do exist, to get students, to get young children immediately plugged into those. In addition, following the work that you all did in 2007, there is a sensory integration benefit that Kaiser has now that is significant that didn't exist before. So Kaiser does some things. But in regard to ABA, we do not provide ABA therapy.
Any questions? I guess just one more. Does running a spirited and real campaign for mayor at 18 indicate any sign on the spectrum at all?
I don't know.
For those of you that don't know, Mr. Okenberg was a very serious candidate for mayor in Portland as a sophomore in college.
27% of the vote.
27%. Not bad.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thanks for your testimony. I'm unsettled. I'm grappling here. How do you deal with the data that were presented by Ms. Unum, the Mayo Clinic data, et cetera, claiming touting the efficacy of the treatment, and your suggestion that it's not nearly as effective?
Absolutely. Let me say two things. One, I would not stand here saying my suggestion of anything. I've done my best in the last year, not only speaking, of course, with my family members, but with the best experts in the field, and actually burying myself in things that I never thought I would, like the Journal of Pediatrics, which just last month took a subset of ABA therapy, ABI, and once again came to the conclusion that there's insufficient evidence that it does work. I have a copy of that abstract that's available online for anyone who wants to. Kaiser, in addition, just last November, did its own analysis of the various studies around the country and came to the same exact conclusion that the Health Resources Commission did as well. So I've just done my best to try and read that and understand it. In regard to a point that was brought up earlier, in terms of research methodologies and that you can discover things, especially when you just look at one child, without a doubt, that is true. In fact, anyone who studies autism spectrum disorder knows that no one child is the same on the spectrum. Therefore, no one type of therapy will necessarily work for every single child. So it does
say no two children are the same.
No two.
Although part of the problem is sometimes no one child is the same either, and that's part of the problem.
Absolutely. And so, like I said, we do not at Kaiser want to fall back on just that because there have been so many studies saying there's a lack of evidence, that we want to dismiss ourselves from the responsibility of finding what the right role is for the medical profession, for community health, for the schools, and so forth. But we will point out that in places like Virginia, where one of our pediatricians, leading developmental pediatricians, comes from, the schools do much more on this, and that they felt they haven't even begun to reach the level of what their side of the bargain should do in this. And at the same time, in regard to the commission that was just created by executive order, we want to play an active role in that. We will have people applying for that. We want to be, specifically one of the charges of it is on this treatment piece. And if we can design better treatment studies, we want to be part of that. I just had a discussion with the head of our Center for Health Research, and that's an area that they're very interested in. One additional note, President Obama, fortunately, in his health budget, announced a fourfold increase for autism study, treatment studies through the NIH. It would be very wonderful if we could, as a state, not just leave this as the evidence is inconclusive, if we could find a way to tap into some of that money, perchance within in concert with OHSU, with CHR, with other folks, and get in the next 2 years some better evidence. But again, just going off the interim work that was done, it does not lead to the conclusion that we need a $36,000 benefit provided by the insurers up to age 21. There is far more nuance to this data than this bill captures.
Yeah, I think there's the methodological argument of the N of one compared to it, and the problem is, I think until we do the studies that need to be done that are acceptable to methodologists without getting in an argument of the N of one question, the answer is going to be up in the air. And it's very clear, and I think Mr. Oakenberg made the point very clearly, that the results generally do not say there is no effect of the data, although there are some subsets where the data are clear. It seems to be no effect. They simply say there isn't enough data yet to say with scientific certainty that that they're effective. And those of us that have spent, as I have, a lifetime doing behavioral research, I understand the complexities of the issue of behavioral research. But ultimately, we need to make sure we make that investment so we really do know what serves. And the problem in this, as in other kinds of complex diseases, is that it's not easy to make general prescriptions for things. That different things work for different kids.
And I've purposely, in regard to the question, not tried to deal with the monetary aspect of this, because when you're dealing with wanting to help one child, obviously you do whatever it takes within your capabilities. But within a public policy framework, that also is an important consideration. It's the same reason why the schools do not provide robust ABA benefit right now in Oregon. There is a significant cost to it for some benefit, but it's across the board and it's not medically proven.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was not thinking about the financial aspects of it at all. You went right where I was hoping you would, and I'm wondering how much of it has to do with statistical analyses. And you know, it's been a while since my statistics classes, but N of one was not something that we had a lot of faith in or placed a lot of focus in on. But I,
if you have some spare time,
yeah,
this is serious. If you have some spare time, I think we'd value your judgment. I've read about 10 cases of material in this. I mean, 10 cardboard boxes full of material in this. I think it would be very useful from your background to get a look at, starting at least with the Oregon Health Resources Commission. And the reason that I asked our prior witnesses is to get us other studies. It would be very useful, although we quickly get mired in the N of one argument. Which is a legitimate argument.
And in addition, we are happy to provide any of the folks that we have at Kaiser, which not only is in this region but has networks nationwide, to get you evidence. And we have pediatricians who are lifelong advocates for autism, both parents and children. So we'd be happy to provide that to you and directly, too, as well.
Dr. Green, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
How about a last word from you?
I would suggest that in evaluating these reviews that have been done of research on applied behavior analysis, that you use the same standards and look for the same conditions as when you review medical treatment. That is, applied behavior analysis is a discipline. It is not the same as clinical psychology. It's certainly not the same as pediatrics. And as I mentioned, this discipline has scientific research methods. Many of the reviews that I've seen have been conducted by people who do not have training in behavior analysis, do not have training in these research methods. And, you know, that's like asking, and that's like having a bunch of us behavior analysts evaluate a medical treatment. I don't think you would treat that as very credible. So I would just suggest that you need some expert behavior analysts to take a look at this treatment. They're the people who know the treatment and who know the research methodology. And I would really recommend looking at the documents, the studies, and this book that's been recently published by the Journal of the American Medical Association on evidence-based medicine regarding N-of-1 studies. They're only talking about one kind of single case experiment for evaluating medical treatments. There are actually several other kinds of designs that are tried and true for evaluating changes in behavior. Remember that at this point in time, autism is behaviorally defined. It is behaviorally diagnosed. And, you know, I would dare say that there are a number of medical treatments for which coverage is provided. For example, I heard the gentleman from Kaiser mention sensory integration therapy. There's not a scintilla of scientific evidence that that is beneficial for children with autism. So, again, I'm recommending holding the same standards that you hold for other interventions, other treatments, medical treatments that are far from perfect and don't produce cures, hold
if we hold that to the same standard, I can assure you there's not a single other therapy mandated by statute. So if we're going to hold it to the same standard, the standard is it's up to the insurance companies and the providers to determine how to treat a disease that they recognize, and that this would not be holding this to the same standard as others. This would be creating an entirely different social policy standard. That's why we're having some trouble with it.
Well, I was referring more to scientific standards and other kinds of standards. And again, I would think that if you were evaluating evidence regarding a medical treatment, you would have people who knew about that treatment, who were experts in that treatment, and who studied that treatment, helping you evaluate that evidence. I'm suggesting doing the same thing for applied behavior analysis. It is not the same as clinical psychology medicine. It's definitely not like a drug treatment or any other sort of short-term medical treatment. It is vastly different than that.
Okay, well, I'm going to end this call, and I'm going to gavel out of this hearing and close this hearing and adjourn the committee. Thank you all very much for coming. The story